Welcome back to the History of South Africa podcast with me, your host, Des Latham. This is episode 230, from Knysna's Burning Forests to Tolstoy's War and Peace, the world in 1869. Globally, the end of the sixth decade of the 19th century was full of fire and brimstone, some technology, some social change, significant moments. The construction of the Port Noloth O'Keeppe railway line is one notable tech development. But on the downside, the Southern Cape experienced a devastating fire that began in early February and destroyed numerous homesteads and ancient yellowwoods. More about this in a few minutes. In the United States, Elizabeth Cady Stanton testified before the U.S. Congress, thus becoming the first woman to do so. And later in 1869, Stanton and Susan B. Anthony formed the National Women's Suffrage Association. Sainsbury's opened in Drury Lane in London in May. Boston University was founded in the same month. A month later, John Hyatt patented celluloid in Albany, New York, a product created by mixing nitrocellulose and camphor, thus creating the basis for the coming film revolution. Like all good ideas, Hyatt had actually bought the original patent from Englishman Alexander Parkes, who couldn't figure out how to make money from his invention. It's amazing how many inventions were co-opted by entrepreneurs after the inventor struggled to make a buck out of a good idea. Take the common computer mouse, invented by Stanford Research Unit student Douglas Engelbart in the early 1960s. In the late 1970s, almost two decades after the mouse's invention, Apple's Steve Jobs saw a mouse being demonstrated along with what was called Graphical User Interface, GUI, at Xerox Labs in Palo Alto, California. Jobs, along with other Apple representatives, decided to adopt the mouse concept and redesigned the upcoming business computer to incorporate the mouse and GUI, despite having previously planned a different direction. The first personal computer to adopt a mouse was called Lisa, and from 1984, the mouse became a standard feature on all computers. Another example of a good idea being co-opted by businessmen was Tesla, founded as an electric car company by engineers Martin Eberhard and Mark Topenning in 2003. Elon Musk sank $6.5 million of his PayPal earnings into Tesla, becoming its largest shareholder. By 2008, Musk had forced both Tesla founders out. This is known as the King Lear of business stories. If you're interested, take a look at the McDonald brothers, Richard and Maurice, who created the brand McDonald's in the 1940s, only to have investor Ray Kroc buy them out for $2.8 million and take over their name. They were banned from using their own name in any future business. Also, in July 1869, Frenchman Hippolyte Meige-Moriez filed a patent for margarine. A month later, Oxford beat Harvard in the first international boat race held in the Thames. In September, a stock exchange crash was set off by the James Fisk Jay Gould scandal in something called Black Friday. This is not the place to discuss that scandal in full, which revolved around price fixing of gold and a whole bunch of shenanigans that implicated American President Ulysses S. Grant. There, dozens of brokerage firms went bust. The two shysters, James Fisk and Jay Gould, along with a coterie of acolytes, escaped prison because they had good lawyers. In November 1869, the first edition of scientific journal Nature was published in London, and the first ever American football match took place between two American colleges, Rutgers University, which beat Princeton 6-4. The Cutty Sark Clipper ship was launched, one of the last ever built. November the 17th, however, was probably one of the most significant dates in 1869 when it came to the Cape, because that was the date that the Suez Canal was completed. For the first time in history, ships could now sail through the canal linking the Red Sea to the Mediterranean, shortening the voyages between Europe and the Far East by months. In Cape Town, there was fear and loathing about the canal. Before I get there, let's just finish off the global events of that year, 1869. Billy the Kid robbed his first bank in December. The first Vatican Council opened in Rome. And on December 10th, the Wyoming Territorial Legislature gave women the right to vote. This was the first time anywhere in the world. In Russia, Leo Tolstoy published War and Peace late in December 1869, mistaken for an impossibly long doorstop of a novel, and fair enough. At over 1,200 pages, it is heavy enough to stun a cow, but its true importance lies in how it smuggles philosophy, history, and a treatise on free will into what appears to be a story about aristocrats dancing, dallying, and dueling their way through Napoleonic Russia. Along the way, it manages to give us some of the richest character studies in literature. Pierre bumbling towards meaning, Natasha whirling between innocence and calamity, and Prince André wrestling with mortality under a sky so beautiful it's almost rude. War and Peace is as much a meditation on history's impersonal tides as it is an intimate confession of human longing. And despite its intimidating reputation, it's surprisingly gossipy in places. Tolstoy couldn't resist skewering his own social set with all the relish of a man writing about people he both envied and despised. And so, to South Africa. Let's retrace our steps to February 1869. It began, as such stories often do, with a wisp of smoke on the horizon. According to local newspapers, the fire that would become known ominously as the Great Fire of 1869 was first spotted on the 8th of February. The conditions were perfect for catastrophe. Southern Cape berg winds, searing northwesterly to northeasterly gusts, swept down from the heights. Born of a low-pressure system sliding from west to east, they could reach gale force strength, tearing through valleys like invisible predators. By the time the flames were first seen near Knysna, the air shimmered with heat, the humidity was almost non-existent, and the vegetation, which was parched after years of relentless drought, stood waiting tinder dry. The role of weather in our tale has always been a combination of malignant and magnificent. South Africans know how the interplay between the perfidy of parched earth and poetic sweetness of soaking rains creates life-changing decisions. The drought had lingered since 1862, killing livestock in their tens of thousands, crushing farmers beneath debt, and driving many to leave the Cape Colony altogether. As an odd aside, many of these farmers who fled from the Cape of the drought of the 1860s ended up in New Zealand, which had become a distant, moist beacon for ruined lives. Ironically, the rains would come soon after the fire because such berg winds often heralded cut-off lows, and those lows brought storms, sometimes floods, but not yet. At the time, the Cape was also grappling with an economic depression. Later that same year, the opening of the Suez Canal would slice shipping traffic around Africa to a trickle, leaving villages like Knysna, which depended almost entirely on ships for cargo, stranded in more ways than one. But in February 1869, the fire dominated the horizon. From its first sparks, it began a horrifying march, sweeping west towards Swellendam, east to Uitenhage, and threading through the Langkloof Valley north of the Otanikowa Mountains. Then, inexorably, it spilled down towards the coast, devouring all in its path, the Great Brak River, Victoria Bay, Knysna, Plettenberg Bay. Few records survive of what the flames actually did to that landscape. The area was sparsely populated, and few diarists or officials were there to witness the whole thing. What we know comes from scattered sources. A report in the George Advertiser, dated 16 February 1869, a letter by Brian Darnell, owner of Westford Farm, and most evocatively, the diaries of one man, Henry Barrington. Barrington, owner of the Portland estate near Rinnendal, northeast of Knysna, chronicled the fire with the precision and anguish of a man watching his world burn. An excellent repository of the event can be found in the Knysna Museum. Barrington himself has been dogged by rumours, with some believing he started the local fire, an accusation his family rejected. There's a bit of evidence that weakened their case, because Barrington had burned a section of his land on the 7th of February, likely a firebreak. Burning your veld is a dangerous thing to do, particularly when it's a season of high winds and berg winds, nochal. Instead of waiting at least 48 hours to ensure that embers had died out, Barrington left his farm the next day on the 8th of February for court business in Knysna, but returned the same day. On the 9th of February, smoke could be seen once more, this time about 6 kilometres north of Portland, his farm. A strip of dense, wet Knysna forest, fire-resistant and evergreen, separated this new blaze from his own burnt lands. On 10th of February, Barrington wrote, "About 11 a.m., it got into the river Knysna to my northeast. It quickly passed down the valley and fired my thatch land and passed down and destroyed Westford House. And every hook of Portland was on fire and all to my west. The fire got into my river kloof a little to my southwest and was burning towards my house backward against the wind. At this moment it seems the village of Melville was in imminent peril when, fortunately for it, the wind turned due west. This, though, was fatal to me."
My God! To what a state we are now reduced! My poor wife, myself, my three sons, and my four dear daughters.
Later he added, his words heavy with loss.
I've lost the labour and collections of a life. All my nice library but a dozen odd volumes, 15 pigs, one poor dog, and 2 ducks.
With house, cottages, and farm buildings gone, the very soul of his farm was erased.
One might as well be on the barest Karoo place as on the beautiful banks of the Nisner River. The grass will grow again, and soon the whole farm will be one sheet of emerald green, but all that gave it value in my eyes is gone. Nature never can restore grand old trees, not a few of them 30 feet in circumference. I've lost everything.
The great fire raged elsewhere for weeks, razing dozens of homesteads across the region. Barrington was not alone in his devastation. When the rains finally came, the felt recovered green shoots sprouting defiantly through blackened ash. But the towering indigenous trees, the giants, were gone from a vast portion of what we call the Nisner forests today. The Otanika yellowwood, the tallest indigenous tree in South Africa, reaching heights of over 40 metres, some are over 1,000 years old. It's characterised by a crown often adorned with old man's beard, lichen and bark that flakes in large dark patches. Then there's the real yellowwood, South Africa's national tree. Other notable indigenous trees in the forest are stinkwood, white pear, Tablaan's beech, and assegai. All of these were burned to death in lower reaches, extinct through the entire region that was flattened by the Great Fire of 1869. In the aftermath, the colonial government took tentative steps to protect the remaining pockets of Nisner Forest, recognising at last how vital its timber was to the Cape economy. But for those who lived through it, like Henry Barrington, no act of government could erase the memory of when fire ruled the land and the Nisner Forest itself seemed to howl. The Cape Parliament had passed the Forest and Herbiage Act in 1859, 10 years earlier, where control of the forest became the responsibility of local magistrates and justices of the peace, and even of the local postmasters. All tried to collect taxes on the timber if they could, but were inadequate in dealing with woodcutters, dihoutkappers, timber merchants, and even government-linked traders. These hid away in the mysterious depths of the forest, like sawn axe-carrying wraiths, determined to make their money from what appeared to be the eternal forests of the Nisner region. The Great Fire of 1869 did more than leave scorched earth and blackened stumps across the southern Cape. It exposed the fault lines and how colonial authorities viewed the natural world, not as an ecosystem to steward, but as a capital asset to exploit. When the flames finally spent themselves, only the forests of the upper plateau, with its cooler, wetter microclimate, had survived. Everything else, valleys, farmlands, lowland forests, was gone. The devastation jolted the Cape government into action. For years, mismanagement and indifference had defined its forest policies. Now, with the Nisner timber economy teetering, there was no choice but to respond. Enter Captain Christopher Harrison, whose appointment as conservator of forests, made permanent in the wake of the disaster, marked a turning point, at least on paper. Harrison joined forces with Thomas Bain, the celebrated government engineer and road builder, to form a Forest Commission of Inquiry. Their task, to investigate the management, or mismanagement, of Crown forests. They, of course, met resistance. Some landowners, including Barrington, argued the forests should be closed off and sold to the highest bidder. They believed the government had failed to harvest aggressively and sell the timber rights, and was therefore squandering its capital asset. In their view, standing trees represented wasted revenue, 1,000 years old or not, they must be chopped down. They were tearing the heart out of the forests and cared not, for they were not of the land. They had not grown up in these forests. They cared not for the future because they had no past there. Modern environmentalists might wince at the prevailing colonial logic, but in the 1860s, it reflected the imperial wisdom of resource economics. Extract, sell, move on. Sustainable yield, biodiversity. Ecosystem services. These were not part of the vocabulary. Harrison and Bain saw things differently. They began to articulate an argument that feels strikingly contemporary, that unmanaged exploitation would exhaust the forests entirely, leaving nothing for future generations. Their commission's recommendations became the first tentative steps towards a conservation ethic in the Cape. It was a beginning, but it was not yet a solution. The fire had revealed a truth we still grapple with today, that forests are more than timber, more than revenue streams. They are living systems, slow to grow, quick to burn, and nearly impossible to replace once destroyed. They are the elegant cathedrals that are alive, swaying gracefully in the same winds today that struck the Southern Cape back in February 1869. Speaking of the Cape, the colony was by now grappling with economic headwinds and a realization that ships travelling to the east would now have an alternative to the Cape voyage, shorter, cheaper. The Suez Canal, yes, had been completed, but for a few years prior, Cape business had been on edge. Reports in the newspapers of the time warned of a coming financial meltdown. Investors had sunk hundreds of thousands of pounds into South African ports, mainly Port Elizabeth and Cape Town, improving wharves and piers. Would all this investment be wiped out by the new Middle Eastern route? Despite the obvious external threat, financiers across the Cape couldn't agree what to do about it. Manipulation of the preponderant Western Cape representatives in Parliament and the divisions amongst Easterners brought about by the rivalry between Port Elizabeth and Grahamstown merchants. They couldn't agree where to build a railway for a start. PE to Uitenhage, Grahamstown to PE, Graaf-Reinet to PE, Grahamstown to Cape Town. From 1868, there was an increase in colonial production in South Africa, a boom for ostrich feathers and wool. Diamonds were soon to drive another growth in financial income, but wool was the main export. Prices had fluctuated, but wool in 1869 made the largest contribution to the Cape Colony's exports, with Port Elizabeth at the heart of the trade. The value of imports and exports passing through Algoa Bay was more than double that passing through Cape Town. The wool came from regions almost forgotten in the 21st century, Fraserburg, Victoria West, Queenstown, Aliwal North, as well as some farms in the Orange Free State. Large merchant houses and the major banks concentrated their activities on Algoa Bay, while Cape Town and Mossel Bay, as well as the newer port of East London, saw trade concentrated mainly around their hinterlands. When diamonds were discovered in the Vaal Harts region of the Northern Cape, Port Elizabeth merchants were also best placed to establish connections in the diamond fields. For the system of supporting upcountry storekeepers had given the bay houses agents in towns close to the diamond fields. Standard Bank was also early in the diamond fields, opening the first branch at the alluvial diggings in November 1870, followed by an agency at Kimberley on January 1, 1872. It was in this way that Port Elizabeth merchants and the Standard Bank became the leading buyers of diamonds, while the diamond fields became the most important single inland market for colonial merchants. But let me not get ahead of our story too quickly. Next, we trace our steps back to Basutoland, for the old man of the mountains, Moshoeshoe, was weakening rapidly. Please rate the podcast on your favorite platforms that helps elevate its visibility, and you can head off to desmondlatham.blog, where I'm loading updates about episodes. You can also email me from there and sign up for my little newsletter. Until next, Salagatli.